When Dewey and LaBeouf declared bankruptcy last year, it represented the largest law firm collapse in U.S. history. Up next, New Yorker staff writer James B. Stewart explains what happened. And then later on, Kevin Barry talks about his latest book, a collection of short stories called Dark Lies the Island. Plus, we will take a look at the sites that have been put on the World Monument Fund's latest watch list of endangered cultural heritage sites. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. When Dewey and LaBeouf declared bankruptcy in May of last year, the New York Times wrote that it was the largest law firm collapse in U.S. history. Just a few years earlier, the firm was being routinely referred to as a global super firm. In his article, The Collapse, New Yorker staff writer James B. Stewart traces the rise and fall of the firm and of its former chairman, Stephen Davis. The article appears in the October 14th issue of The New Yorker, and I'm very pleased that it has brought James B. Stewart back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
Although the 2007 merger that created Dewey and LaBeouf is a turning point, the story you tell starts in 2003 when Stephen Davis became chairman of LaBeouf, Lamb, Green, and McRae. What did he do when he took over that position?
Well, he took a look at the evolving landscape of law firms and concluded that his firm, the LaBeouf Lamb firm, was in an uncomfortable mid-level, that there were the smaller boutique niche firms, did high margin, high profit specialty business, and then there were these growing giant firms that were serving clients all over the world. And he figured he had to go one direction or the other and decided to go for size. He didn't see the boutique option as really feasible for LaBeouf Lamb. He was probably right about that. So the only alternative was to somehow to grow. How do you grow in the world of elite, high-level law firms? He decided that you spend money to grow, and that's the strategy that he embraced. And he was hardly alone in that. Many other firms were heading in the same direction.
Well, there are two options. You either merge with another large law firm, become a larger one, or you poach top lawyers from other firms. He chose the second approach?
Yes. I mean, there have been many of these big mergers, and the track record isn't all that great. Taking, you know, large groups, their own cultures, their own personalities, their own histories, suddenly trying to put them together. A law firm isn't really a corporation. It is a partnership. The chemistry, the human interactions are very important. And there hasn't, as I said, the track record has not been so great, although some have succeeded. The other option is the poaching one. And this, you know, I worked in a large law firm now decades ago. Poaching was just non-existent. And poaching is really just a byproduct of the rise of money as the measuring stick for lawyers and professionals.
Poaching is different than just having a lawyer come to you from another firm. You're expecting the lawyer to bring his clients with him.
Yeah, I mean, poaching is a kind of, I guess, pejorative term. It's these bidding wars were breaking out for prominent partners at different firms. And who was a prominent partner? It was someone who controlled clients and therefore could generate revenue, and revenue became the holy grail for law firms to measure their own success.
Didn't Stephen Davis also cut costs at the same time?
Yes, he certainly did. I mean, he did a lot of, you know, prudent management things. He got rid of underperforming offices, closed some smaller regional offices, took a cold, hard look at, you know, the balance sheet, the who was generating the revenue, who wasn't, the compensation structures. Again, taking a much more business-like approach, which has, you know, again, a trend that has swept law firms. And he did that with some success, but you can only cut so far.
Was he well-liked by the other partners?
I think he was. He's a very genial character. He's, I think I say in this story, he kind of comes across as some kind of a cross between a diplomat and a professor, maybe. He's even-tempered, he's mild-mannered, and as you see the story unfolds, if he could be faulted, it was mostly for maybe being a little too popular, for telling people what they wanted to hear, and especially paying them what they demanded.
Compensation at LaBeouf was different than at most other firms of its caliber. Why do most major firms follow what's known as the Kravitz system? How does that work?
Well, the cravath system is an interesting approach, and I worked at Cravath years ago, so I experienced it firsthand, although I wasn't a partner. But the partners are paid a fixed amount every year based on the firm's profits, tied only to seniority. It has nothing to do with have you generated a new client. It doesn't even have anything to do with how many hours you work. It is really a partnership that depends on mutual admiration, respect, and trust in one's partners, that if there's one year you don't have such a great year, well, you'll make it up the next. I mean, business moves in cycles. Maybe bankruptcy is in one year, it's not the next, but things all even out. Everybody works hard, and you prosper together. You rise or fall together. Now, that actually was once the dominant model in all the major national firms, certainly the ones based in New York, Washington, Boston, a few places like that. That's been under attack for years. In fact, I would say now it's a very, very distinct minority of firms. For a variety of reasons, including clients, it became much more bottom line sensitive and much more willing to pit firms against each other and move their business around. That collegial model has been eroding, and it's been substituted by these kind of merit systems, or, again, to use a pejorative phrase, eat what you kill systems.
We could also call it performance.
Performance, yes. Where compensation is very closely tied to a performance. But what does performance come down to? It really is revenue producing, which means controlling the client. So you see in doing LaBeouf, and it was hardly alone in this, it goes on all over the place now, and lawyers complain to me about it all the time. There's ruthless competition to control the client. Even within the firm, you have partners trying to steal clients from their own partners and thereby get credit.
But it also would lead lawyers to want to have only handle only cases where there's a lot of money involved rather than cases that might have important legal aspects to them.
Well, money just... I mean, if
this
there's
all
any
sounds
overriding,
like the plot lines of The Good Wife.
If there's any overriding theme to this story, and I don't think Dewey LaBeouf is in any sense an isolated example, it's the rise of money as both a measuring stick and the way that many lawyers derive their satisfaction from the work. And again, I don't want to sound like an old fogey, but about some glory days, but I always thought people went into any profession for the satisfaction of helping others. The fact that you might be well paid, that's great, but that was a collateral benefit. That was not the main motivation. And that has all been swept aside in this obsession with rankings, with charts. Who has the highest profits per partner? The American lawyer produces this ranking of both revenues and profits per partner. And that has become the holy grail of these firms, to march up those rankings, to be at the top. And yet, when you think about it, the sole criteria of those rankings is money. Nobody's interviewing the clients to say, did they do a good job? Nobody is saying, how many cases did you win? Nobody is saying, who did you help? It's strictly money, and you unleash that genie in any group of sort of competitive people, which you get of these top firms, and you see the consequences at Dewey. It just, money became the holy grail, and its cousin, greed.
It's lucky for Clarence Darrow that he was a lawyer in an earlier time, obviously. Davis decided to woo a Star Securities litigator named Ralph Ferraro away from Debevoise and Plimpton. What were Ferraro's terms for coming to LaBeouf?
Well, by the standards of a big law firm, they were somewhat astonishing. He calculated what his retirement pension income would be if he retired at Debevoise, which was a cravath-type lockstep system. It still is. And I think it came to something like $400,000 a year, which he was entitled to. And then he figured out, well, what's the lump sum payment to me today that after tax would generate roughly $400,000 a year in income? And he came up with a number of $16 million. So he wanted another firm to give him $16 million to guarantee what he would have gotten there in order to move. And many firms wouldn't have paid that. This so-called signing bonus was, you know, pretty much unknown. But Davis said, well, look, we've got a star here. He's exactly the kind of person we want to add. I think it's a good investment. They agreed to pay the $16 million. They also gave him a guaranteed compensation, which was similar to what he would have had at Debevoise, a lockstep system. And that seemed like a brilliant move because he came in. They immediately landed the litigation work for this big insurance client, Zurich. And they that client alone generated $40 million the first year. So it looked like a win here. I paid $16 million, but he brought in $40 million in revenue.
But all of this sounds to me more like the sort of thing we hear from financial firms than law firms.
Well, I think this is an important point. I mean, I think back. I'm not a legal historian. But when I was at Cravath, I mean, nobody really talked about money at all. I mean, I knew the partners did well. I could see that in the firm directories they had multiple houses in very nice streets and neighborhoods and towns. But nobody talked about money. Then I remember after I left a few years later, the merger boom was going on Wall Street. And suddenly I heard lawyers, partners at big firms saying, wait a minute, Bruce Wasserstein, I may be making a couple million, but Bruce Wasserstein is making tens of millions. Why is he making that kind of money and I'm not? And so then some lawyers said, oh, maybe I should be an investment banker. And some of them did, and then they came back. But money became a bigger factor. And then it continued even beyond that, where, again, this compensation system became very performance-based, to use your term, money just became the measuring stick.
Well, did this create two classes of partners, the ones who had a contract and then everyone else?
Yes, it did. And I think Steve Davis was well aware that there was a danger here, that you start treating, because Ferrara got a guarantee, well, then some people heard about that, and they said, why am I not getting one? So then they started asking. And the implied threat here, and again, it goes back to this poaching issue. The implied threat was, if you don't give it to me, then I'm going to leave. It's a kind of a small variation of what we're seeing in Washington now, where somebody kind of holds a gun to your head and says, give me what I want or I'm leaving. I don't know where this whole attitude has sprung up in our culture, but it seems more and more prevalent. And so Davis was faced with, increasing demands from people who said, oh, I want a deal like that. And he started giving it out. But he knew if everybody found out about it, there'd be jealousy, resentment, turmoil in the firm. So it was kind of kept under the radar. Nobody really knew the full extent of it.
My guest is James B. Stewart. His article, The Collapse, How a Top Legal Firm Destroyed Itself, is in the October 14th issue of The New Yorker. And we have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Davis's right-hand man, or his hatchet man, depending on your point of view, was Stephen DeCarmine. What was his role at the firm?
He essentially carried out. He was the manager. He was the executive. He wasn't a partner, but he was the kind of ran it. Davis and his executive committee would make the big policy decisions, and then they would hand it over to him to sort of execute this, which gave him enormous influence. He was talking to Davis a lot about it, and then he was the one who would sit down and hammer out these deals, negotiate the deals with people who were unhappy.
He had an interesting family history. Well, did anyone at LaBeouf know about his cousin Vinny?
A few people did. His cousin Vinny, it turns out, who he was raised with, they were practically like brothers. His cousin Vinny was the head of the Bonanno crime family. And after he was convicted of, I think, two murders, and he was placed in solitary confinement. There were various restrictions on visitors, and in order to visit him, DeCarmine had to file a public document indicating where he was employed. So he realized at that point it was being made public. So he went and he told Steve Davis about it, and he told the head of litigation. And he said, if this is an embarrassment to the firm, I'm willing to resign. And they said, well, no, you're not in the mafia. It's your cousin. So that's fine. But so he did visit his cousin, and he later testified in his death penalty hearing. But I think beyond those two, very few people knew, none that I know of for sure, but there were rumors and there were some suspicions. I thought it was sort of interesting that he would take associates and some others to dinner at this restaurant called Rayo's, I guess it's how it's pronounced, which I guess is a known meeting ground for organized crime families.
It's a celebrated restaurant, but it's hard to get into unless you know somebody.
I guess. I don't want to cast aspersions on the restaurant. I have no idea of this, but because of they would roll out the red carpet for him, so that led to some minor suspicions. But no, I don't think anyone really knew that he was tied to a leading crime family in the country.
It's sad that his cousin Vinny didn't become a client because he probably could have generated a lot of fees. Another key figure in the story is Alexander Dye, who was the head of the firm's powerful compensation committee. He had his eye on the chairmanship?
Yes. His mentor had all but told him that he would be the chairman and that he would succeed Davis when his term ended. And I think he was quite surprised, shocked, and angry and upset when a year before Davis's term was supposed to end, Davis came to him and said, oh, the executive committee wants to extend my tenure. Maybe do you want to get on board? And he was very, very upset about it. So, yes, he felt he had been deprived of a leadership role that had been promised him.
After Davis maneuvered to have himself reelected the chairman of the firm in early 2007. And then they had a confrontation.
Well, you know, it's fascinating that the story really, from that moment, it's a straight line sequence of events that leads to the firm's collapse. But you can, stepping back from the particulars of the Dewey thing, which are, you know, are quite fascinating in and of themselves, but I find it interesting that I don't think there, it was that this was the match that, you know, started a fire, but the conditions had to be right. And once you had a firm culture that was fiercely focused on, you know, do you want to call it performance, revenue generating, money oriented, then you had intense internal competition. You didn't have the mutual respect that you would, I remember, from a cravat, and instead you had intense rivalry among the partners, disparagement of certain partners towards others who they felt were not carrying their weight. And in the case of this, you had a major revenue-producing partner like Dye, very angry that he was not given the leadership role that he deserved, and who then resorted to, in some incendiary emails with his colleagues, pointing to others who really were not carrying
starting a rebellion, in fact.
Yes.
And then Davis decided to merge LaBeouf with another firm. He had earlier thought that that was a bad approach.
Well, he, rightly or wrongly, felt he had no alternative because Dye was now angry. He was upset.
But he hadn't left. He was still generating a lot of income.
He was generating a large amount of income. He was generating an unhealthily large amount of income for any one partner, probably at any one firm, he and his close allies. Davis, rightly or wrongly, thought that Dye was going to leave, might leave at any moment, and that would have been devastating to the firm. And he needed a corporate department. Dye would have walked out with virtually a huge chunk of their corporate business. He needed a corporate department. The only way you can get an instant corporate department is to find one in another firm. And that led him to Dewey, very prestigious name, but a firm that it had also fallen on quite hard times.
And then came the financial meltdown.
And that was completed the perfect storm. It all might have held together and worked. Other firms have. But the stresses of the financial crisis particularly hit them very soon after the merger. And to keep people happy about the merger, again, what was the reaction to get people to stay? Money, throwing more money at it. They raised the target bonuses and compensation for everyone at the firm 25% across the board in 2008. And of course, when the results for 2008 came in, profits, not surprisingly, were down. So they couldn't meet those promises.
And then there was another problem. When they merged, Morton Pierce, who was the co-chairman of Dewey Ballantyne, was given a very lucrative contract. And when things got tough, he wasn't willing to take a cut?
Not only did he not take a cut, he went in and demanded more. He wanted a huge increase. Even though his own revenue and billings had gone down by something close to 50%, he went in and demanded more. And the implicit threat was, again, I'm going to leave if you don't give it to me. And by the way, there are other firms that will pay me this kind of money. So if you want to keep me, you have to pay. Now, I've heard words like, you know, ransom thrown around. I don't know that we need to even get to that. But Davis was shocked, but it was a reality he had to deal with, that a major leader in the firm was putting his own interests first to that extent.
Now, the firm was having trouble collecting on outstanding bills. I'm assuming other law firms were going through the same thing, and that you usually get credit extended. Why was it a bigger problem for this firm?
I don't think it was any bigger, but they were in a more acute situation than almost any other firm because of all these promises they had made to their partners, these guarantees, the target bonuses. I mean, this is all well and good as long as revenues kept getting bigger and bigger. There was a bigger pie to carve up. But what happened when the pie was shrinking? And part of the reason was clients were slowing down on paying their bills. you know, many transactions, the client doesn't pay till the transaction is done, like a merger. And then in October of 2008, all these deals just froze. Nothing was getting finished. So that revenue stream just dried up. So what did they do? They'd made all these promises to the top people. They honored those, but they had to come up with the money somewhere. So they cut everybody who didn't have the promise. The rank and file got slashed. And when they found out that, you know, other people were getting paid in full, many millions of dollars, where they were getting pared down to, shock by lawyer standards, low levels, that created tremendous dissension and ill will.
At a meeting, you quote Davis as saying to the partners, "It's only money. If it's only money that holds a firm and its partners together, then there's really no glue at all." He was being prescient, wasn't he?
Well, he was very prescient, and I have to think that when he said the "if," he knew what he was talking. It wasn't if, it that's what was happening. The only glue they had was money. And he was living this every day, a constant barrage of people threatening to leave. They didn't get what they wanted.
So did they stay or did they leave?
Well, you know, again, Pierce, you know, expresses himself in the story as saying, you know, more or less, well, I wasn't really going to demand $60 million payment, or I wasn't really going to do
because
this.
Because he does look like one of the villains of the piece here.
Well, I guess, you know, readers have to draw that conclusion, but he certainly made these demands. He said, well, I wouldn't really have done it. You know, well, he said he was going to do it. I mean, was this just a negotiating ploy? Again, just to analogize to Washington, are the Republicans really going to do this? Are they saying they are? At some level, I think you have to take people at face value. So there were these constant threats, and they didn't have the money to pay everyone. And eventually people started defecting. The Dye group did, in the end, leave, and that was... It didn't last long after that. He was right in his decision to keep them early on and pay what they wanted. Maybe Davis shouldn't have done it, but it's certainly true that when they did leave, it was downhill very fast.
And the firm filed for bankruptcy on May 28, 2012, and Davis was sued. By whom?
Well, everybody has been sued. There's been lots of litigation, but what I think shows the bitterness of this particular collapse is that Davis, DeCarmine, probably others in the firm as well, are the subjects of a criminal investigation by the Manhattan District Attorney. Now, I believe this is completely without precedent in any law firm collapse. I mean, yes, there may be bad feelings. Other firms have gone bankrupt. To my knowledge, no one has run to a prosecutor, tattled on what was going on, and launched a criminal investigation, and then, by the way, leaked it to the press, because this cloud has been hanging over them now.
What was criminal? Well, I mean, we recognize that DeCarmine has criminal connections, and and Davis were the last two men standing.
Right. It has nothing to do with the organized crime link, to the best of my knowledge. Grand jury is hearing evidence now. The DA is very close to the vest, but what they're looking at, as best I can tell, I'm talking to everyone involved with this, the only potential criminal activity would be in some kind of representations that might have been made when they were trying to get bank loans to the end, like were they making fault? The potential grand jurors were told that they're investigating whether fraudulent audits of the financial performance were made in connection with trying to get these loans.
Now, you write about firms that are known as, I don't know how to pronounce this word, I have not.
Varines.
Varines. I have mispronounced the names of all of these law firms. What are Varines?
Well, Varine is a Swiss term. I guess it's German. And it refers to an entity that it's not a partnership, it's not a corporation, it's kind of a constellation of separate business units. And some of these giant global firms are now becoming these. So each like maybe regional or urban office is its own separate business entity. So they'll carve up the revenues and the profits independently of the overall firm, although they supposedly are cooperating and steering business. It's a relatively new model. The two biggest firms in the world right now are Varines, and a lot of people are watching with interest to see if this can solve some of the problems of the giant global firm.
Is it your sense that they are the future of the legal industry?
I'm very leery of them. I think... again, maybe I'm a dinosaur at this point, but that the old cravath model remains tried and true form.
Do you think if the cravath compensation model had been kept at Dewey LaBeouf, whatever, that it might have survived?
Well, it's funny because you see in the waning days, everybody at Dewey LaBeouf saying, we've got to go back to the cravath model. We've got to get back to that. Look, it's not going to be easy. I'm not saying the pure Cravath model works, but something closer to it, I think, would have helped. I think Davis himself recognized the contracts had gotten out of hand, the guarantees were out of hand, money had swept everything else aside. It was too late at that point, but yes, I think that is the answer for many of these firms.
A reminder that we have a link to James B. Stewart's article called The Collapse, How a Top Legal Firm Destroyed Itself in the New Yorker. We have a link to it on our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. I really enjoyed it.